10 WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the Civic
ABC
Media app.
ABC News, I'm Andy Field. Congressman Kevin McCarthy saying he loved every minute as House Speaker. He's leaving with optimism. He was removed from the position on a 216-210 vote, spearheaded by Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz and a group of far-right Republicans.
You know it was personal. It had nothing to do about spending.
Gaetz saying Republicans could not count on McCarthy.
As it turns out, getting 200 Republicans to trust you isn't enough to stay Speaker.
McCarthy's removal comes just days after he struck a deal with Democrats to keep government open and funded at current spending levels for 45 days. The House has now canceled votes for the rest of the week. During arguments, the Supreme Court sounded skeptical of a conservative-led challenge to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, that agency created after the 2008 financial crisis to regulate mortgages, car loans, and other consumer finance. Officials say Ukraine, Poland, and Lithuania have agreed on a plan that they hope will help expedite Ukrainian grain exports. This is ABC News. The trial of fallen cryptocurrency CEO Sam Bankman-Fried is underway.
The first of two criminal trials against Sam Bankman-Fried, starting off with jury selection, then opening statements in the case of the disgraced cryptocurrency executive. He was initially hailed a guru, then labeled a scammer, for allegedly bilking investors in his bankrupt cryptocurrency exchange FTX out of more than $8 billion. But the federal government also accuses SBF of using customer funds to make more than $100 million in campaign contributions for the 2022 midterm elections. Conviction on all counts could land him more than 100 years in prison. He's pleaded not guilty. Derek Dennis, ABC News.
More than 75,000 Kaiser Permanente workers ready to go on strike for 3 days beginning tomorrow to protest unfair labor practices and short staffing levels at hundreds of hospitals and healthcare facilities. Macy's is taking a new approach to address falling foot traffic by announcing plans to open 30 small stores in strip malls over the next 2 years. Andy Field, ABC News.
Missed your favorite show? It's easy to find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Apple, Google, or civicmedia.us.
For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly. A Wisconsin judge today blocked a southeastern Wisconsin school district's policy of allowing students to change their names and gender pronouns without parental consent. According to a Fox 6 report, the lawsuit stems from a 2021 incident where school district officials used a male name and male pronouns to address a 12-year-old girl who was questioning her gender identity at the time, but ultimately decided not to transition. The lawsuit was filed by two conservative activist law firms. Law enforcement authorities are investigating an armed robbery at the Wisconsin Credit Union on Claremont Avenue in Eau Claire. The robbery reportedly occurred around 12:30 p.m. on Monday. The suspect fled from the scene on a motorized dirt bike before police arrived and no injuries were reported. Officials say the suspect has not been located and is between 5'10 and 6', white, bald, and with a mustache at the time of the robbery. Police say he is considered armed and members of the public should not approach him. For Civic Media News, I'm James Kelly.
My name is Teresa Barber. I was in the United States Navy, and I served overseas in the Middle East and Africa. Early on in my career, I had a commander that taught our suicide prevention training, and the very next day, he took his own life. 90% of suicide attempts involving a gun are fatal. My way of continuing my service is to help protect my community by being a responsible gun owner and by storing firearms safely. Store all your guns securely. Help stop suicide.
Brought to you by End Family Fire and the Ad Council.
Time out!
Oh, right! Remember, we're a team that plays together. Listen, the winning will take care of itself. We just have to get everyone involved.
In interscholastic sports, we celebrate what makes every one of us unique. And in the pursuit of a common goal, everyone in the huddle, in the bleachers, and in the community comes together. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
Red Delicious, Honey Crisp, Granny Smith. If you have a favorite apple, now is the time to pick it straight from the source. Did you know Wisconsin has more than 300 apple orchards? Travel Wisconsin recently naming its favorites, including the Oneida National Apple Orchard outside Green Bay, Ferguson's Orchards in Eau Claire, and Apple Holler south of Racine. Many provide tons of family fun in the fall, too. Tire swings, lawn bowling, hay rides, and more. Apple experts suggest if you want to pick yours fresh, do it before the end of October. For Civic Media, I'm
Why are interscholastic sports called the last classroom of the day? Because they teach students important life lessons like teamwork, accountability, and perseverance. School sports are so much more than a game. They're about developing the whole person. That's why they're an essential part of every student's education.
Encourage your student to participate in the last classroom of the day. Interscholastic Sports in Wisconsin. This message presented by the WIAA and the Wisconsin Athletic Directors Association.
If you love them enough to listen to them practice the same song on tuba,
please be done.
Over and over and over and over and over. Then surely you'll check nhtsa.gov/the right seat to make sure they're correctly buckled in the back seat.
Sounds good, honey.
Check today at nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
We've all felt left out. And for people who move to this country, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Bank-approved corporate news and commentary? Are you tired of CEOs telling you what to think, who to hate, and who to vote for? Well, welcome to the Rick Smith Show. We don't take orders from some boardroom, and we don't do focus groups or talking points. We don't work for them, and we never will. I'm Rick Smith, and I work for you. Join us daily at thericksmithshow.com and download the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I was reading a story over at the Detroit Free Press talking about being on the picket line after midnight. And look, you know, I gotta give my next guest credit. Most reporters aren't going to put themselves anywhere at midnight, especially on a picket line. So the fact that she was willing to go out there and see what striking workers are doing in the middle of the night and understand what it is like to walk in their shoes. As I've been saying, with all of these strikes going on across the country, it's time for every politician, every working person to adopt a striker. Find a picket line, find a striker, walk with them, bring a donut, a bottle of water, a couple of bucks to throw in the strike fund, but spend some time listening to what they say. Find out what it's like to work in those facilities. Find out what the benefits and the pay and all that's like, and what they're actually fighting for, not what our corporate-controlled media is throwing at us. And here to share some thoughts on her most recent piece for striking UAW workers, Picket Line Feels Different in the Middle of the Night, written by Phoebe Wall-Howard. She is an automotive reporter over at the Detroit Free Press. Phoebe, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for including me.
So let me start with, Why are you on the picket line after midnight?
So that's actually my preferred time. When my editor asks what part of the state I'm going to or other states and what time, my preferred choice is always between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. And those are the stories that I've been doing. I like to be in the union hall at 2 and 3 in the morning. And I like to be on the strike line when people are exhausted. And I find that's when they're the most interesting and honest, and no other reporters are around. That's the key for me.
Yeah, no, I give you credit for that. That's incredible. And I saw this story and I'm like, wow, of course it would be you doing this. Because as someone who has walked picket lines, especially overnight, I know it's a tough time to get anyone out, let alone a reporter. So what'd you find? I mean, when you're out there walking and talking, what did you find?
So this last one was between midnight and 2:30 a.m. I went to a Stellantis warehouse. So keep in mind, people need to remember that these warehouses are sending the parts to repair vehicles, right? To car dealers and to repair shops. And it, you know, one warehouse can mean $1 billion in revenue for the company, just one. Yep. So these guys, men and women, one thing I love about covering automotive and particularly factories is the diversity. And it's every kind of person, every ethnicity, all age ranges. People were not angry. They're very devoted to the cause and very matter of fact. So I found that interesting. People would talk about they love their jobs. People have had amazing other jobs and they've come to the factories. That was surprising to me. The amount of education that people talked, that, you know, shared with me that they had. But they said to me, family members told them to go work for the Detroit Three, no matter how much education they had, because it was safe. At the end of the day, you would always be able to provide for your family and you would always have healthcare no matter what changed in the economy. So you listen to how these people are reflecting on words of their parents and grandparents. And it was so much about the fabric of our society. They talked about jobs in America, but it wasn't Buy American. It wasn't other companies are bad. What they said is, this is about maintaining our power, our independence, our freedom. And, you know, when we're in conflicts, whether it's COVID-19 and the automakers make all the masks we need here in this country or other things, I mean, that's what these factory workers talk about. And I just kept, I mean, people would talk and I would pause and say, oh my God, you know, the words are really beautiful, but they were powerful and right. They were strong and they were proud. But like I said, I was taken aback by the lack of anger. It was an absolute commitment to the cause. This is a union membership that is very devoted to UAW President Sean Fain. He obviously has a more bombastic style and people appreciate that.
No, he's fighting the class war. And I think that's a great thing.
Well, and I think he's raising issues that people don't think about. But what was so striking to me is that people on the line, while they're talking about the points he's making, that the whole demeanor is different. Like I said, I've asked people if they're scared. I've asked them if they're anxious. Are they worried about paying bills? And people say, now is the time. Nobody is going to come help us. We have to help ourselves and we have to help each other. And one man, I've spoken to countless people on various strike lines. And one of them said to me last night, I have no mother and father. I have no children. I have no spouse. I have no siblings. I could retire tomorrow. I'm here walking the strike line in gratitude for the people who came before me. And I'm devoted to helping make life better for the people who come behind me.
And what's interesting, Phoebe, is, you know, I heard those exact same stories because I walked that same picket line up in Centerline, Michigan at the Stellantis plant with Sandy and Andy Levin. We were up there, you know, the weekend before last. And, you know, the same kind of things. People who had spent 50 years in that, I think it was 52 years, the guy said he was there. And it was his being there was about the legacy that he wanted to leave. And he wasn't happy where things are. And I think those are important stories for the general public to hear, because all we keep hearing is, well, they're just greedy. They want more. And without understanding that they've given up so much over the last several years, that this is kind of a fight that has to be had.
Well, the beautiful thing, I just did a piece on what auto workers actually gave up in 2007 and 2009. And members of the public wrote, they called, they texted me and said, we've never seen the list itemized. And we didn't realize it was so significant and big things. And so sometimes just taking it out of the drama and just listing it in bullet points, yep. I cited contracts, I cited, you know, the actual agreements. But I think the American public is really paying attention. I think that manufacturing and non-manufacturing, again, I like to remind people, you know, one thing that Mr. Jensen mentioned is talking to people in New York who are broke. And it's no coincidence that the UAW is rapidly expanding, whether it's Boston College, Columbia University, Harvard, University of Connecticut. I mean, the UAW has organized all of those and so many more. So higher education is helping fund the strike line. You know, I talk to those people in academics and they say they are honored to help pay the $500 a week for auto workers. It is their honor that their dues are being used. That's what a diversified union does for you.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure this story got you some pushback as well. Not everything's bread, not everything's roses and rainbows. I'm sure you got some distractors here.
No, I mean, there's definitely been criticism for sure. You know, this is a really, I don't think people thought it would be as rough as it has been. And it's been rough and people aren't sleeping. I mean, people are anxious. They want this to be over with, but they will not break the strike line. I mean, they'll tell me no matter how nervous they are, they're staying the course. And frankly, they respect the strategy of cherry picking locations. We didn't know how it would work that some employees would be in the factory while others are walking a strike line. And all of them have said it seems to be working very well.
Well, when someone asked me about that, I said, well, what you do is you're going to target the places that you think are going to cause the most pain to get them to respond. But if there's layoffs that happen, maybe you get to collect unemployment and you don't deplete your strike fund. It's a smart strategy to not put everybody out on the line and deplete your strike fund right away. I think strategically they've done really smart things.
Well, I was actually quite surprised that some states will provide unemployment while other states for the very same conditions will not.
Right.
And it wasn't like Kentucky will. That surprised me. And those are legislative moves that whether you're union or non-union, you know, that activity makes a difference. That little legislation that goes through in the night has an effect at times like now.
Yeah. Now, you had mentioned during the break that, you know, you had gotten some pushback from people, from you writing this story, that you were humanizing these people, because I think these stories have to be told. I think you know understanding who these folks are. They're your neighbors. They're your friends. They're your family. I think back to when I was a kid, and I've told this story 1,000 times during this strike. The neighbor, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, and the neighbor got a job at Ford, a UAW job, and immediately their lives got better. They had food at the end of the month. You know, they got a secondhand car. Eventually, they moved out of the neighborhood entirely. Their lives got better right before our eyes, and it was that union job that did it. So union job, better life was the message that I got as a young kid. And I think we can see that again in these kind of actions and these kind of strikes.
Well, one thing that was also surprising to me on the strike line is the number of local restaurants who are bringing food, an enormous amount of Mediterranean food, a lot of pulled pork. I mean, beautiful. Yeah. People packaged up salads and pulled pork, lots of juices, tons of fresh fruit. But it is surprising to me that whether it's food trucks or small restaurants, diners, the strikers are really stunned by the local small businesses who are supporting them, partly because their wages go right back into the economy. You know, I like to remind people that if you earn, $20 million a year, it's unlikely that all that is being funneled back into the economy. You know, that's going into investments and other things. That's fine. But when you give a pay raise to a factory worker, they're spending it. And, I've talked to people who said that this is really just about fairness at the end of the day. It's really about fairness. And I think you're going to see some of the company executives come around. I think that in coming days and coming weeks, we may see a shift.
I hope so. I sure hope so. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Phoebe Hall Howard. She's the automotive reporter over at the Detroit Free Press. Freep.com, the website. We'll get links out on social media. How you can take a look at this. Now, obviously, as the automotive reporter, you walk an interesting line. Walking the picket line, I don't know, endears you to the people in the corporate suites, because obviously as the automotive reporter, you've got to walk this line. How do you deal with that? And do you expect blowback? Are you getting blowback? How's this playing?
You do get blowback sometimes. I have to say that after 6 years, I have such strong sources in factories that my stories I really depend on factory workers. So when I get draft proposals for these talks, for contracts, and I need to know what's happening, I have sources that are close to the UAW and family members and different people, but they also seek to have me confirm things that they're hearing. So I think this is a fine line that you have. Again, we're beat reporters, we cover the company, but at the end of the day, all year, we have to cover the UAW because the workers are an essential part. The company is nothing without the workers. I mean, everybody knows that, and that is a fact, but how this is going to shake out, the amount of money at stake, and at the end of the day, if people... This demonizing of electric vehicles, and it's happening a lot. The bottom line is electric vehicles have to have an infrastructure. People need to be able to charge. But if people just trash electric vehicles, I mean, that is what's going to contribute to job loss. All these automakers are making the pivot. They've invested tons of money. And but to see some elected and non-elected officials just tear into EVs is really weird. I mean, it doesn't seem to be helpful to anybody.
Well, it's an ideology. I mean, it's a blind faith belief that, you know, all of the climate stuff is, it's a hoax. Or, you know, it's just being, you know, they see it as a political advantage to divide people. And it's a divisive issue at this point, and it shouldn't be. You know, moving to better technology, moving to a cleaner economy should not be that divisive, but this is the world we're in. Last question I've got for you. You know, like you said, you've got a lot of inside sources. You're hearing a lot of things. Anything to report? Anything, any progress that might give us hope that this could be short-lived and workers get back to work and families get food back on the table and all that stuff?
I think that what I heard from workers, both from GM and Stellantis, is they are actually looking to Ford, even though this is not pattern bargaining this year, they actually are looking to Ford to set the pattern. They feel like that company has the most at stake because all of its high net worth vehicles are made in the U.S., right? They're completely dependent on the UAW for the whole F-Series, F-150, Super Duty, everything. Those are the big margins. Those are the big profit sharing checks for workers. So if Ford can set a pattern, we've seen that General Motors really has begun to mimic things Ford does, whether Jim Farley is out having a news conference, Mary Barra comes out immediately after, you know, goes after Sean Fain. But we'll see what happens. Ford is absolutely committed to bringing this thing to a close. They just submitted, they announced today that they've submitted a seventh contract counter proposal. So we'll see how the UAW responds, but we expect a lot of big news this week.
I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that because, look, nobody wants to be on strike. Nobody wants to lose a paycheck. People want to do their jobs, support their family, and move forward. But sometimes you gotta fight the good fight. And this is that good fight. But Phoebe, I appreciate you taking time for us. You do amazing work. I hope everyone takes a look at it. Freep.com is where you get her stuff. We'll get links out on social media. Phoebe Wall-Howard, I appreciate the time.
Thank you, Ray.
Awesome stuff. And again, like I said, make sure you check out freep.com. She does incredible work. She is the go-to person on anything in the auto industry. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around and listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working deep. Come to talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425. Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
I gotta tell you, amazing. Just amazing stuff. And the fact that Phoebe's willing to go out on that picket line at night is good for her. Because, look, I've done the overnights on the picket line. That's when a lot of chaos, that's when a lot of stuff happens. That's when, you know, when jokers want to pull nonsense, when you get people who want to try and cross. Yeah, it's a lot of you never know. And I give people credit. You know, look, it's one thing, you know, when the sun is shining to be out there, you know, walking the picket line. It's a whole nother thing to be out there 2-3 o'clock in the morning, you know, and a commitment to do the overnight. And I was thinking about, you know, some of the stuff that's happened over the years that I remember. And, you know, fighting the good fight is never easy. But when you're fighting the righteous fight, and this seems the righteous fight, it's worth it. And I give people credit. And like I said, I give Phoebe credit for going out there. And as she was telling me about being there overnight, I was remembering, you know, there was a strike going on not too far from where I'm at. And I was, you know, I was the person kind of leading it and making sure everything goes smoothly in the overnight. This is several years back. And a guy crossed the picket line and, you know, caused a ruckus and then ended up calling the police. And, you know, he was upset that the people who were on the picket line were calling him a scab because that's what he was. And, you know, he threatened the people, said he had a gun in his car and all this, all kinds of craziness that went on. And the policeman, you know, came over and, you know, had no idea what was going on, had never seen a strike, you know, and had never, you know, had no idea of what was happening and no idea why people would be upset. And this is one of those, you know, kind of, you know, vulgar-esque stories that I had to tell this policeman. You know, I said, you know, Joe the scab here crossed these folks' picket line. You know, there's a relationship here that Joe has thrown himself in the middle of. You know, Joe the scab should know better than the throw himself in between, you know, someone else's fight. And I said, look, are you married? And he's like, well, yeah, of course I'm married. I go, so have you and your wife ever had a problem? Have you ever, you know, gotten into an argument? Has she ever gone off to her mother's and you guys are, you know, at odds? He's like, yeah, we've had our differences. And I go, now imagine you have one of these differences. And, you know, she goes off to the mothers and you're not talking and you're angry at each other. And you come home from work, you go, you put on your Sunday best, you get all gussied up, take a shower once this week, you know, put on the aftershave, do all that stuff, buy flowers and roses and candy and all kinds of stuff. You're loaded to bear to make everything okay. And you pull over to the mother-in-law's house, you walk up the sidewalk to the white picket fence, and you find me engaging in activity with your wife. How are you going to feel about that? You going to be angry? You going to be upset? He goes, yeah, I do. You would do exactly what these workers did when Joe the scab crossed his picket line. Because there's a relationship here between the company and the employer. They're struggling. They're having a little tiff. They'll come back together. They're going to get back together at some point. It's going to happen. But to have these people interject themselves into this relationship, it's going to cause tension. It's going to cause anger. People are going to get upset. Just like you would do if someone, you know, tried to horn in between you and your wife when they're having problems. It makes already inflamed moments that much more difficult. And you know, fortunately, the officer got it, sent Joe the scab on his way, and was done with it. And that to me is you know, the kind of stuff that happens, unfortunately, especially when you have people who want to interject themselves in the middle of these things. And the hope is that they stop. Let's go to the phones. We got Howard on line one from Santa Fe. Howard, what's on your mind, buddy?
Hey, Rick, I'm living well in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
Outstanding.
Because I joined a union, the TWU 513.
Outstanding. I'll tell John Samuelson.
Airline workers.
You're doing well.
Well, I'm doing all right.
Good.
I was hired at $8.16 an hour when I started working for the TW in 1983. And when I retired, I was kind of forced out in 2005, maybe. And the people that they were replacing me with were getting $8.50 an hour.
Wow.
Almost the same pay that I started with 29 years earlier.
Yeah. No, it's disgraceful. You know, I've got almost the same story. I started in the freight industry in the late 80s and, you know, was making, you know, $15 an hour, you know. You know, up until this last contract, you know, the starting rate was just $18 an hour. And you know, $3 difference over 30 years of increase. And, you know, because wages have been stagnant, union density's gone down, lots of problems. But things are good now, right? You're okay?
Yeah, I'm okay. You know, I've done other things since I got out of the airline business, but, that's done more for me than when I was in the airline business.
I'll bet.
Luckily.
Yeah. 15 seconds. Last thought.
Last thought. 15 seconds. Get on the line. I'm gonna put my hoodie on and go walk any strike line I can.
My hero, Howard. Love you, buddy. Adopt a striker. Good stuff, Howard. Love you. Gonna take a quick break. Right back after this. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1967. That was the day that the Dust Bowl troubadour, Woody Guthrie, died. Over the course of his life, Woody Guthrie wrote almost 3,000 songs. He was one of the thousands of people who took to the road during the Great Depression, swept into wandering by the winds that churned the Dust Bowl. In an interview with NPR, fellow folk music legend Pete Seeger described Guthrie's influence, saying, quote, "We all read about music being part of people's lives, but I hadn't seen it in action until I met him. The words that came out of his mouth and the music he made all flowed together with the life that he led, and I was greatly attracted to it and kind of tagged along with him for several months. Woody showed me how to hitchhike and how to ride the freight trains, how to sing in saloons." A 2013 article in Paste magazine summarized Guthrie's legacy, writing, "No artist has ever expressed a deeper will to fight against oppression and the rights of the little guy than Woody Guthrie." Iconic author John Steinbeck wrote this vivid description of Guthrie: "Harsh-voiced and nasal, his guitar hanging like a tire on a rusty rim. There is nothing sweet about Woody, and there is nothing sweet about the songs he sings. But there is something more important for those who will listen. There is the will of a people to endure and fight against oppression. I think we call this the American spirit."
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
What amazes me about outbreaks of bribery among high government officials is not just the level of greed involved, but that the take is often so cheesy. For example, there seems to be no end to the ongoing saga of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's peddling his position and prestige to right-wing corporate titans for what? Free rides on their jets, golf outings, and assorted baubles. He's supposed to be an impartial justice, but he consistently supports rich interests who are picking up his tabs. We taxpayers provide $274,000 a year in salary to Thomas. Why wouldn't he buy his own baubles and protect a smidgen of his judicial integrity? Now comes New Jersey's Senator Robert Menendez, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, who has been oddly insistent on giving U.S. weaponry and financial aid to Egypt's repressive military dictatorship. Why? Because Menendez has sunk butt deep into influence peddling, using his position to advance Egyptian interests. In exchange, Egyptian agents have blessed him with huge wads of cash, gold bullion, a Mercedes-Benz convertible, and a no-show job for his wife. Oh, they also delivered an air purifier for his home. Seriously? An air purifier? That's a mighty cheap sellout. Yet, what a priceless symbol of the whole stinky deal. Meanwhile, Menendez says that the donations are unrelated to his honest concerns about our Mideast foreign policy. He proudly asserts that his senatorial assistance is just the, quote, normal work of a congressional office. This is Jim Hightower saying, sadly, he's right. Most Senate offices today routinely do official favors for moneyed interests in exchange for millions of dollars in bribes. But that's such an ugly word, so they call the big money payments campaign contributions. Then they get indignant when we call the system corrupt, but that's what it is. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
Well, you're not going to have Kevin McCarthy to kick around anymore. I keep getting this image in my head of him and John Boehner getting drunk and getting stoned. Because evidently Boehner, that's all he does now. He's a lobbyist for the pot industry in Ohio. Between drunk and stone, and he's got to be laughing. I know when he was a speaker, he was crying all the time. This has got to be hysterical to him. Because the party showed him the door in a most unceremonious way. So to see this again, the Republicans doing what Republicans do best, causing chaos. But here to share some thoughts on the big story today, McCarthy's ouster. I've asked Marcus Barham to come talk with us. Marcus is the contributing editor over at Capital in Maine, the website capitalinmaine.com. Marcus, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rick.
So what do you make of the whole debacle of our conservative friends not being able to keep their own house in order?
I've got my popcorn and I'm busy munching away. I mean, it's chaos, and it's interesting because it lends itself to so many wild conspiracy theories. For a second this morning, I think I tweeted there must be some liberal Roger Stone who's been talking to Matt Gaetz to get him to take this action that's going to totally disrupt and tear apart the GOP. And then sure enough, Roger Stone himself tweeted like this afternoon that he supports Matt Gaetz and how ridiculous it is, that I think he said that Newt Gingrich, who's, opposing Gaetz's action, should be deported. So it's just total chaos. And there's so much infighting, and it's fun to watch. Because it doesn't bode well, obviously, for the future of the party, at least in Congress.
But sadly, it doesn't bode well for the future of the country. I mean, this is my problem. While I'm enjoying watching them eat each other, and thankfully the Democrats didn't do what Democrats do, feel the need to go in and save the Republicans from themselves. Sadly, this is more destroying government, more government doesn't work, more, they're going to blame the Democrats for this because this is their MO. This is what they do. This is who they are.
Right. But you know what the plan is now? The plan is a push to have Trump become speaker.
Yeah. I joked about that earlier. When's he going to fit that in, though, Marcus, between his 91 felony trials?
I know.
Him losing a quarter of $1 billion in fines, running for president, running to McDonald's. How's he going to find the time?
I know. I don't know. I don't know how he's going to do it. It's true. And I'm not sure what it means. It's true in terms of the country and the agenda moving forward. It's difficult because the House can't get anything done, obviously.
Yeah. And look, as you said, they can't get anything done. We just, for a couple of days, we're talking about the fact that, child hunger, child poverty went up in this country almost 60% because we couldn't get a child tax credit pushed through to ensure that we kept child poverty at a very low rate. One of the lowest rates it's been in my lifetime. That was a choice of dysfunctional government, of dysfunctional Republican government.
Yeah. Exactly. No, exactly. I mean, basically, when the Congress let that child tax credit lapse, and it cut child poverty in half, which is an incredible achievement that very few people know about. I feel like I talk about that every week, and most people, even liberal neighbors of mine, don't realize that achievement. And now it doubled again in 2022. And so as a result, a lot of states, I just wrote about this last week, about 11 states now have expanded or launched their own child tax credits. Including states like New Mexico, which have very high rates of child poverty. And some of them are very generous, involving credits of thousands of dollars. And I think Minnesota's plan is to cut child poverty by a third. That's the goal in that state, if not
but
more.
But here again, this is red hat, blue hat stuff, it sounds like to me, Marcus. It sounds like a lot of the blue states are going, okay, well, the federal government is dysfunctional and not helping our children. We're going to do this for our kids. But still, these red states who, screw those kids. Yeah, we want them born. We want to pop them out. But we don't want to feed them or clothe them or educate them or get them health care or any of that stuff.
I know. Meanwhile, Sarah Huckabee Sanders just spent $19,000 on a new lectern, which is a big scandal apparently in Arkansas. And I was looking it up, and $19,000 is more than half the average salary in Arkansas. So she took that money to buy a new lectern, new podium to make speeches about the need to keep cutting funding for education.
I'm not even there. There are so many jokes there. I'm not even going. I'm not going through it.
I know.
I'm not opening that can of worms. Huckabee Sanders is a joke all of her own. But here's the one thing she's done very well. She's going to get kids back into the workforce. We're making child labor great again, Marcus.
That's right. That's right. I know it's happening in a lot of states. Which is kind of hard to imagine that it's one of those things that it seems like a relic of the 19th century. You know, kids working in mines all covered in coal dust, and that we're way beyond that. And yet we're sort of back to that. And every day I see stories about kids at factories or in fast food restaurants who get injured on the job when they shouldn't be there in the first place.
It really is
shocking.
See, now I have this, I talked about this earlier. I have this theory of this is where we're heading. And maybe you can help me here and tell me if I'm crazy or if this you think is possible. You've got this whole movement because we're cutting off immigration, so we can't get cheap labor to come in and do agricultural work or meat packing work. So we're going to take, you know, minority children. We're going to push them into the workforce. They don't need school anyway. Get them into the workforce. Then simultaneously, the Christian right in their fetish to destroy public education will voucherize education so they can have the backpack full of money, you know, so they can pay homeschoolers to educate their own children and indoctrinate them with their twisted beliefs. But we're going to make employment educational. So now we're going to take that backpack full of money and we're going to give it to employers. We're going to pay employers to get cheap labor from our children. And of course, not our children, but, you know, minority children and poor children.
Right.
We're going to get them. So we're literally going to pay abusive employers to take children and work them in overnights and in horrible conditions. Any thoughts on my brave new world?
That is what they could do is maybe join the picket line and go on strike and join their fellow colleagues in Detroit and in Hollywood and now with Kaiser. This obviously they could be part of the labor movement. The Kids Brigade could be part of the strike force.
Yeah, I think of Mother Jones, you know, the famous story of the March of the Mill Children, you know, marching to Teddy Roosevelt's vacation home in New York. And you go, you know,
I mean, to be honest, it could be a smart move by the labor movement. The more this expands, that would be a great, great way to build support is to have like kids in the picket line. I mean, the idea that kids are out there working and being paid, working hard and probably being paid poorly, it says everything.
Yeah, it's crazy where we are.
It really is a crux point. It's fascinating how right now, I mean, the strike movement is just like growing. Like wildfire.
No, people are angry. Look, you know, we were talking about the UAW strike. I guess tomorrow there's the potential of, you know, some 50,000 Kaiser Permanente workers going on strike. We've talked to the folks.
It could be more than 75,000, actually.
Okay, well, 75,000. You know, we talked to the folks in Vegas at the Culinary Union. Could be some 50,000, you know, bartenders and hospitality workers. You know, we're talking to people all around the country where, you know, potentially big strikes are happening because people are fed up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, if those workers go on strike, there's more than 75,000, that would be the biggest strike by healthcare workers in like recent US history, which is just incredible. That hasn't happened in decades and decades.
No, it's remarkable to me. And you know, but I keep hearing people say, well, what about the patients? You know, look, I'm concerned about the patients. Absolutely. But what about the workers? What about their conditions? You know, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, obviously it's one of those things. Who cares for the workers? I mean, do the hospitals and do the health insurance companies, do they care about the patients? Because if they did care, they would do whatever it takes to get them health care. And if that involves giving raises to healthcare workers who are on strike, you do that. Because you care about the patients, because you want the patients to get good care.
Yep.
And so that's what it takes. You don't want to have disruptions. You don't want to have lack of care, obviously. Even if you don't care about that, it's going to lead to litigation and all kinds of problems for you. So it's in the best interest to meet the demands of these workers.
And what's interesting to me, you know, I'm sure you remember that nurses strike up in Buffalo. I think it was St. Vincent's from a couple of years ago, where the hospital literally spent like 10 times in trying to break the strike that it would have cost them just to give the nurses what they wanted and needed. I mean, it's that kind of ridiculous. And the same thing with the UAW. How much are they losing? How much would it, I mean, just a cost benefit analysis of how much you're losing compared to if you just treated your workers decent. I mean, it's crazy to me.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting there is how the UAW is being smart by strategically thinking. They're looking at the pocketbooks too and looking at the money, and they're by basically doing strikes that are timed to hurt them the most. And yet they're still like waiting in the wings for, striking at the truck factories and the SUV factories, knowing that that's really going to hurt the automakers, especially the big three, which is very strategic and very smart. Because I think in the past, previous, auto strikes weren't like that. They were just sort of like across the board, and they would just, do it where they could. It wasn't as planned and strategic when it comes to where the money is and what's going to hurt the automakers the most.
No, they've been very smart in what they've done. But for me, and this is what I wanted to really talk to you about, is, out of this strike, seeing a more militant UAW, there's talk of Tesla workers beginning to organize. I know the story had said they want to organize an independent union, and they're going to follow that path. But ultimately, this kind of militancy, this kind of potential victory could be, advantageous for the UAW in organizing other companies and other facilities, I think.
No, absolutely. I mean, that organizing pressure could spill over to obviously Tesla, like you mentioned, but others, especially foreign manufacturers like VW, Honda, Toyota, all those companies could be, pressured to raise wages to meet the new union rate. If the UAW is able to win that with the big three, that'll naturally have a spillover effect on these other companies.
Yeah. Well, like we're seeing with the UPS, what UPS is doing to the delivery market. I mean, you're seeing wages come up at Amazon and at FedEx because they don't want those workers to unionize. I keep saying, though, if you work for FedEx or for Amazon or for any delivery company, get that union contract, get it in writing because they can always claw it back.
Right. Right. No, exactly. And they have to be prepared, I think, especially those kinds of workers for, taking on the companies when it comes to the pressure to make deliveries. I mean, those UPS drivers are under constant pressure to make a certain amount of deliveries per hour or per day, which means that leads to accidents, that leads to mistakes, that leads to stress, which has been found, across the board. It's happening more and more.
It leads to injuries, all that stuff. Last question I've got for you in looking at, into the crystal ball, what are we expecting at Kaiser? What are we expecting to happen? Could be, as you said, the largest nursing strike. What are we expecting tomorrow?
I mean, I expect, maybe I'm optimistic and glass half full, but I think that they're going to make a deal just because it's like so key not to, I mean, that would really hurt Kaiser, not just in terms of the patients. Maybe you don't care about that as much as their profits, but in terms of the optics and to have all these healthcare workers with very compelling stories out in the picket line, knowing what's happening to patients and how patients depend on these workers, I think it's really going to hurt. And they're going to, try and strike a deal to make this go away.
Well, we'll see how it plays out. And as it goes on down the road, I'd love to hear your thoughts. Hope to keep us up to date. Love the work you guys are doing over at Capital in Maine. Hope folks will check out the website, capitalinmaine.com, where you can get all of your worker-centric information. Marcus, I appreciate the time. As always, great stuff.
Definitely. Thank you, Rick. Great to be here.
Our good friend, Marcus Barham, he is the contributing editor there at Capital in Maine. Again, capitalinmaine.com, the website. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. Listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're working people from the talk. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1943. That was the day the United Packing House Workers of America was chartered under the CIO. The new union was the result of the CIO's Packing House Workers Organizing Committee. Started in 1937, the Organizing Committee was an effort to build a union that broke down barriers between race and crafts in the meatpacking industry. Chicago was at the heart of this effort. Workers in the meatpacking industry faced grueling, often unsafe working conditions. The stockyards in Chicago had seen the failure of two major strikes. The first was in 1904, the second in 1921. Racial and ethnic divisions had plagued both of those strikes. The organizing committee made inclusion the heart of its efforts. It also reached out into the communities. This broad approach to organizing that has come to be known as social unionism. This approach recognizes that workers face issues that go far beyond the shop floor. The efforts paid off with the founding of the new union, with its headquarters located in Chicago. They won a major strike in 1946. The union became one of the most progressive in the nation. The United Packing House Workers of America was one of the earliest unions to back the fledgling civil rights movement. Union leaders supported Dr. Martin Luther King and the Montgomery bus boycott. In 1956, they invited Dr. King to Chicago to share what was happening in Alabama. One of the organizers of the United Packing House Workers of America was a man named Les O'Rear. Les went on to live to be 103 years old. He was one of the founders of the Illinois Labor History Society, which helps bring you these Labor History in Two segments. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Show.com. Let's quick go to the phones. We got Steve in Chicago who's been waiting patiently on line one. Steve, how are you today?
Well, like you, I'm somewhat ambivalent. It couldn't happen to a nicer party, but at the same time, I do wonder about the long-term impact that it has on our republic. I don't have any love for Republicans, but I do want to see them as a functional party because I think as a country we need two functional parties. At the same time, you know, I wonder where this leaves us because, you know, this is really like a bunch of children who don't have a plan other than I want my dessert before dinner. And so, okay, they've ousted McCarthy. The Democrats were not going to save him. Obviously, you know, the Democratic Party is thinking about 2024. The largest cohort in terms of the growing electorate are independents. And for Democrats, they see this as an opportunity to pull over more of them by allowing the Republicans to bury themselves as the party that can't, you know, govern its own house. So I don't know what McCarthy was thinking, that somehow Democrats were going to rescue him. That wasn't going to be the case. So now the question is, okay, where do we go from here? There is an interim speaker. Of course, now a lot of scholars are combing through everything that there is on this because there isn't a lot on this. To what extent do his powers extend? Apparently, he has the full powers of the speaker, but it was intended that this be a short-term position,
right,
before an actual speaker could be elected. So given the dynamics, we don't have anybody who's really capable of winning. Certainly, the Democrats don't have enough votes, and Republicans are torn, so who could be the speaker? Which leaves an interim speaker there indefinitely. Now, there's nothing that prohibits that, but the question is, you know, what power do they actually have? And it's rather frightening given that they're third on the list in case anything should happen to Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. Again, it's an interesting time. I mean, I'm tired of firsts in the last 8 years. I'm tired of being on that list of, oh, well, first time in American history, I'm tired of that. I want to go back to boring public policy that conforms to norms.
No, but here's the thing, and I'm right there with you. We are 100% on the same page. But this plays right into the Republican, their MO. This is what they believe. They believe government can't and shouldn't be allowed to do anything. And that government's broken. And then they set out to show us just how broken Republican government is. So, you know, for me, I don't see there's, for them on their side of the aisle, much of a downside to this. But you're right. It's the independence that, you know, Democrats should be courting. And it's my view that, you know, Democrats should do nothing to try and save McCarthy and the Republicans in this moment, especially given McCarthy's stance today. I mean, when he came out and said, you know, we're gutting funding to Ukraine unless you give us everything we want on the border. And just, you know, that's not how you negotiate. He lost right from the start.
Oh, yeah, you're right. And I would say that perhaps we differ a little bit in that I think that there are two Republican parties, at least on that question of, you know, not wanting to govern and basically thinking of government as an impediment to the private sector. I think that there are certain people who actually believe that nonsense. And then there are others who are good at the rhetoric, but they realize the importance of government to the private sector. You know, I mean, their billionaire friends, you know, like Jeff Bezos and others, they didn't build the roads and interstates and airports. That was paid for by taxpayers through government appropriations and funding and so forth. And, you know, when they talk up a good game about, you know, government being the problem, but most of the sane ones know the government is essential in a modern society, especially one that's with an economy as large as ours. We didn't get here because a handful of crazy billionaires managed to make all the great decisions over the last 150 years. We got here because government invested in education and infrastructure and research and development, so many other things. So, yeah, I think that they know better. But again, you know, they're the absolute crazies and the ones who just are good at the rhetoric.
Right. So let me ask you the question then, Steve, because, you know, we don't disagree on this at all. Only I take it to the next step, which is worse, someone who believes what the rhetoric is or someone who uses the rhetoric because of political expedience, knowing better, but still puts that out there for the masses to believe that he believes what he's saying. Which is worse, the true believer or the one who's just using it to get elected?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's like asking, you know, is the crazy person worse or the liar who knows full well that they're lying? You know, so who's worse? I mean, yeah, you could definitely make the moral argument that it's the person who's lying, knows full well they're lying and is abusing the system. I would say that there are people in the extremist part of the Republican Party that don't give a damn about what's going on in this country and what's good for the country. They want a gig. Matt Gaetz is looking for some gig on Fox or somewhere else, you know, after his career. And make no mistake, his career is his days are numbered. There's already an ethics investigation. There wasn't a prosecution with regard to his, shall we say, questionable moral behavior with the underage persons. But the House is still debating that issue, and if they find that he's guilty of that, they're going to move for him to be expelled. And he doesn't have very many friends in the House.
Nope, because he put them in a jackpot right now.
Yeah, any excuse that they could use to get rid of him. So they're not exist. They're gonna. It's not like Santos. They're gonna come and put up with him, you know. Because once the ground clears, or rather the air clears, then, you know, and they're not forced to count votes by single heads. They're like, hey, we're not in power anyway. Okay, just get rid of Matt Gaetz. He's not doing us any good anyway.
There you go. Appreciate it, Steve. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good stuff. And look, you know. Again, I agree 100% with Steve. You know, while I'm watching this for the entertainment value, the sad reality is we need a functional Republican Party to have functional government. You need sane, rational people. And like I said earlier, I had hoped for about 13 seconds yesterday that was going to be possible with Kevin McCarthy. The shutdown was certain. There was no way that McCarthy was going to cut the deal to kick the can down the road, even a week, and ultimately 45 days, which maybe he knew going to need those 45 days to figure out who's going to be speaker. What do we do if you still have the bow tie wearing Wall Street puppet, McHenry as the acting speaker off of the super secret list? You know, what do we do? Does he have the ability to move legislation that's going to avoid a shutdown? Or does this end up where we're stuck? Because understand, again, all spending emanates from the House. They have the power of the purse. All of it starts in the House. And if you can't get a bill out of the House that that, well, is sane and rational, and you can't get it through the Senate and through committee and eventually signed, what happens come Thanksgiving? Because understand, you need the government open and functioning, especially during the holidays, you know, the busy corporate season. You know, when corporate America makes most of their profits off of us. Going to be interesting to see where this takes us. But I want to hear your thoughts. If you got an idea, I want to hear it.
You're listening to WLAK 1260 AM Amory and WBZH 910 AM W245 CT Hayward. Always streaming on the
ABC
Civic
News,
Media app.
I'm